I think it is on.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the latest European Institute Perspective on Europe topic lecture. We're extremely pleased to welcome the Vice President of the European Commission. She is responsible for the budget, human resources, and all sorts of other things, and I'm reliably informed that more than a third of Commission staff report directly to her. She is the lady. But she's not boring by talking about the budget, because there are more interesting things happening in Europe at the moment. In particular, some of you may have noticed there's something of a migrant crisis. And therefore, the title that we've given tonight is Too Important to Fail, Humanitarian Financing in a More Fragile World. Now, I'm not going to run through the very distinguished biography of Kristalina, because that would take far too long. Anyway, you all know how important and clever and smart you are. Just to announce one thing, she's an LSE alumnus. That's the most important feature of you from your background. Forget all the other places like Fiji, where you do graduate research, and MIT, they can go somewhere else. Anyone interested in reporting on this? There's a hashtag, too important to fail. So tweet away if you want to. And without further ado, Mr. Hill, may I invite you to take the floor? I gather you have a roving mic, so you can wander
Yes. Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for coming tonight. I'm trying to find a place where I wouldn't be on your way, maybe right here. Yes, I was here in 87, 89. In these days, my country, Bulgaria, was on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And it wasn't too far in the future when we started in Europe what has been an amazing process of enlargement, with many countries, including my own, joining the European Union. Well, when I'm here today, this process, for all practical reasons, for now is brought to a stop. The Commission I'm part of came in office saying that we do not anticipate any new member state to join the European Union between now and when we finish in 2019. And actually what is much more worrisome, I think, is the fact that those of us who love Europe are quite anxious on whether the process of enlargement may actually be reversed. And even worse, there are those who are thinking of, wouldn't be a great thing if the European Union gets out of business. So it's a very different world we live in. And the question is why? What is happening? And I think that we have to all recognize that what is happening is we live in a world that may be richer, maybe technologically much more advanced, but it is also a much more fragile world where shocks are frequent. They often overlay with each other. They create enormous anxiety in all countries. If you look at the United States and what is driving the incredible march forward of Donald Trump, it's anxiety more than anything else. And we have the same here in Europe. You may be asking yourself, why on earth, in a program that deals with Europe, somebody would be talking about humanitarian aid? And what I want tonight is to give you a very simple and straightforward answer to that. And it is that in Europe today, we are preoccupied primarily with domestic issues, for a good reason. In many countries, the economies are not doing so well. UK is doing better, but even here, youth unemployment is in the order of, 13%, 14%? we have been hit by financial crisis, economic crisis, Eurozone crisis, terrorism, and now a refugee crisis. And all of this makes us look for what we can do inside. And I think that this is justifiable, understandable, but also fundamentally wrong. It is very important for us in Europe to pay much more attention to what is happening in the rest of the world that impacts us. And my job tonight is to talk about what I call the most important solvable problem. And it is the one for which we have been mobilized, a group of us, to do this report, Too Important to Fail. How we can get the gap in humanitarian financing closed, and why it is important to do so. So Ban Ki-moon in May last year called on 9 of us. My co-chair is the Sultan of Perak of Malaysia. From the UK, we have Hadil Ibrahim. She's the executive director of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. And it is a mixture of people coming from government, private sector, civil society. Most of us didn't know each other. The only person on this panel I knew before I started to do this job was Margot Wallström, the Foreign Affairs Minister of Sweden. But it happens that we came as a group very quickly on the same page on what I thought was the most important starting question. And the question is, who do we work for? What's the answer? What do you think? Well, here is this group, 9 people, called by Ban Ki-moon. Who do we work for?
UN.
And that kind of looks like we work for the UN. Any other thoughts on this?
Humanity.
Humanity, yeah, you're much closer. We actually decided very quickly in the first 30 minutes of our discussion that we work for the people whose survival depends on whether or not we find a solution to this problem of filling the humanitarian financing gap. And then we started on our journey looking into what is causing this problem to be so important. If you, for a second, imagine that people in need of humanitarian assistance to survive were a country. 125 million, this would be the 11th largest country in the world, just between Japan and Mexico. This is, if it was a country, if it were a country, to be used proper English, also would be the fastest growing country in the world. The number of people in need of humanitarian assistance in the beginning of this millennium was 36 million, so it quadrupled in 15 years. And life in this country is extraordinary. People live in fear. The vast majority of children, especially when they're girls, don't go to school. The adults have no jobs. And they depend on handouts to live day after day after day. Very dramatic problem in thinking about this humanitarian emergency is that a great deal of crisis actually we don't talk about. We recently started talking a little bit more about Yemen. But if you look, I mean, I'm sorry this is so difficult to read. I didn't do the graph. If I did it, you wouldn't be able to read it. But the biggest, which country do you think has the biggest number of people in need? Just answer right off the top of your head. Nope. People in need of humanitarian assistance to survive. This is people who are affected by either conflict or natural disaster or both.
Yemen.
Yes, it is Yemen. And this is something that normally when you have a conversation like this, normally people would say Syria because it is on the radar screen, or India because it is the biggest country in population terms with largest number of poor people. But when we talk about humanitarian assistance, the category of people we talk about is those whose lives are destroyed by either natural disaster or a conflict or a combination of both. And what we see in the world is that this number of people is going up and up and up exponentially. Why? Because of climate change? Because the force of nature hammering with the strength that we did not have even 15, 20 years ago? Because of violent extremism, and also because of growing inequalities that make some parts of the world more fragile than others. So when people are hit, they have no resilience, they have no resistance forces to survive. When we look at the last couple of years of fairly difficult time for multilateral decisions, there were two things that happened that are kind of hopeful. One is the Paris Agreement on climate change, and the other one is the acceptance of the Sustainable Development Goals, 17 goals for the world. And if you recall, in these goals we say what should be dominant is leave no one behind. These are the people who are left furthest behind. And among them, we also have what is now a problem that we started understanding in Europe a little bit more. We have almost half of the population of this country being displaced. And again, what you can see on the map is where the biggest displacements are happening. So in Europe, we talk a lot about the 1.5 million people that have come to Europe. But we talk not enough about the 59 approximately million that are displaced somewhere else, very often from one poor country to another. One of the biggest numbers of displacements is actually into Yemen, the country that on its own has produced the largest number of people in need. Or you take a country like Ethiopia, 730,000 people displaced in Ethiopia. So you go to Ethiopia and you talk about the European crisis, and they kind of look at us and say, "Oh, what are you talking about? We are much poorer, much smaller. We have had the 730,000 people for a decade. You don't hear us complaining." Well, for an European audience, for the conversation we have today, for people who actually are focused on Europe, obviously a very important point, and this is what I hope you would remember, is that when we talk about humanitarian emergencies, no more somebody else's problem is just somebody else's problem. Travel travels, and it has come to Europe, and actually you can see it coming. I was commissioner for humanitarian aid for 5 years. 2 years ago, I was in Lebanon and Jordan, and then I wrote to the ministers of foreign affairs of Europe that this refugee crisis, unless it is addressed in Syria, where it originates, and unless people are helped where they are, it's going to come to Europe. You can see it coming. It's like a slow-moving tsunami. And of course, what did our people say at this time? Oh, they said, very interesting, big problem. We should do something about it. And this is what we have been trying to address with the panel, to say how big is the problem and what we can do about it. Now, this is how big the problem is. We have been actually methodologically... Are there people here who are economists or development economists? Okay, so not many, but at least for you this would be very familiar. One of the big questions when we talk about financial gap, how much money do we need to solve the most important solvable problem, is to define how we measure the gap. And for a long time, there has been a big problem on that, because it was measured on the basis of United Nations appeal. So something bad happens, there is a big emergency, people make an estimate of how big it is, and they put a price tag. The problem with this is that it's subjective and very often inflated, and very often it is a summary of judgments of different agencies. So UNICEF would say we need that many millions for children, World Food Program would say we need that much money for food, and then this is aggregated. And then the rest of the world says, yeah, okay, we don't quite really believe this number. And we as a panel said, okay, let's find an anchor that gives us a number that is believable. And that what occurred to us was, wait a minute, we know that it is accepted that the survival of a person requires a minimum of $1.25 a day. If we take this number and we multiply it by 125 million people in need, and then we discount, because not all of them need help all 365 days of the year, then we come up with $40 billion needed, and we know that we are funding it at the level of $25 billion today. How does $25 billion sound to you? Like a lot of money? Not a lot of money? Who thinks it's a lot of money? Raise your hand. The person who knows development says it is a lot of money. Who thinks it is not that much? And three people think it's four. It's not that much. What do the rest of you think? What do you think? Okay. Very good answer. So let me try to give you a bit of a perspective on that, and then let's see whether we would have a judgment. The world produces a GDP of $78 trillion. So that's one number. Since 2000, the money we spent on humanitarian aid has gone up from $2 billion to $25 billion. And that's another set of numbers. And at the same time, the impact of humanitarian crisis on the rest of the world and the threat it causes way beyond where conflicts happen has skyrocketed. In Europe, today, a country like Austria would say that a refugee to be looked after costs 20,000 euros. It's another number. A refugee, if you take our calculation of $1.25 a day, so we're talking about $400 for people where they currently are. So the difference, the cost difference between looking after a displaced person in Ethiopia and a displaced person in Europe is 20 times, 30 times. So when you have all these numbers, and the position we take is we ought to be able to find $15 billion so we can help people where they are, because it is morally right and also because it is in our own self-interest. Big number or not a big number? $15 billion. If you were to be voting on a budget and say you're here in the UK, you can make a choice to have more money for refugees in the UK or to help more refugees in Lebanon or to do both. How would you vote? Now I'm asking everybody.
Lebanon.
Lebanon? Do more in Lebanon. Well, basically, the problem we face in Europe today is that either we muscle the will to address the root causes of crisis and help people where they are, or we would see the wave of displacements going up and up and up, and their impact on Europe, on the fabric of Europe, on the politics in Europe, growing. This is a simple matter of choice. In our work in the panel, we came up with, In our work in the panel, we basically came up with three sets of recommendations on what should be done, how we can deal with this $15 billion gap. And the first set of recommendations is basically very commonsensical. The very best way to deal with humanitarian emergency is not to have it in the first place. Invest more in conflict prevention, conflict resolution, disaster risk reduction. Bring solutions to people where they are, help them more. There was a conference here on Syria in London. Have you followed this on the news?
Yeah. Huh? Commented on it as well.
You commented on it?
Yeah.
I would be very interested in your comment on the conference actually. What did you think?
Well, because I'm from Lebanon, so I have to follow it and comment on it as well.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, big declarations of generosity is appreciated, but also. Coming back to your thought that small countries like Lebanon, where they burst
mm-hmm.
with refugees, it gives another set of problems which is not related to money, related mm-hmm. to social pressure, to things that you may not be able to follow with money.
Mm-hmm.
However, money, it does help, as governments are making, you know, for right reason and for wrong reasons sometimes.
Yeah, well, what happened in... that's a very good analysis. What happened in London on this conference on Syria were three things. All three are very significant. The first one is that the pledges were incredible. $10 billion. You know, it goes a long way to bridge the gap that I'm talking about. Secondly, for the first time, pledges were made on a multi-year basis. People said, look, this is not going to end tomorrow. We have to think about this year and next year and the year after. And the third very interesting development was that people said, and we have to invest in education for children and jobs for the adults. Because if we don't, then we are creating the next generation of very disfranchised people. And of course a fertile ground for more extremism in the world. One very important point we made for countries like Lebanon and Jordan in the report was when we provide grants, when we provide support to countries affected, we always do that on the basis of the income per capita of countries. So if you are a poor country, well, India is not that poor anymore. It used to be. If you are Ethiopia, you are entitled to receive grants. But if you are Lebanon or Jordan, because income per capita is higher, you can only be receiving loans. And yet, in Lebanon, one-third of the population are refugees. In Jordan, they are in the order of 12, 13, 14%. So our message here is don't forget about income per capita. This is an outdated criteria. Follow the people in need and make sure that we help them. The second big part of our work was on, okay, we shrink the needs. But even if we shrink the needs, with these two drivers, climate change and conflicts, unlikely that we would see really melting down of this $15 billion. So where do we get them from? And we came up with 1111. They're equally important. I don't know what happened here on the slide. They're all equally significant. We came up with recommendations that are basically all of them possible, commonsensical, but require political drive. They require the world to kind of wake up and say, ha, we have to do something about it. The first, and I think it is the most important recommendation, and interestingly enough, one that we share with Wolfgang Schäuble. We basically said, let's look at this humanitarian problem. Is it the same as it used to be? In the past, humanitarian emergencies, more or less, were temporary phenomena. Something happens, and then Red Cross comes, or Médecins Sans Frontières, or UNICEF. They help for a month, two, three, and then they leave. But no more. Now we have crises that go on and on and on and on. The Syria war is now 6 years. The situation in Iraq, even longer. If you look at the Palestinian displacement, it's in the decades. So can we really continue to treat this as a local temporary problem, or we need to look at it as a global problem with a very different nature? And our conclusion is, this is a global problem, very different from what it used to be, and it requires a very different funding mechanism to address it. And as Minister Schäuble said, the solution should be that we have a levy that generates a permanent flow of funds. In his thinking, he said, well, gasoline is now very cheap. Why don't we put the 5 cents on a liter of gasoline tax, and it goes to fund solidarity with refugees in Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Ethiopia, Yemen. How do you think this proposal of Schäuble... independently of him, this is what we are saying in our report. We say we need to find a way to source money that is predictable, and it is based on bringing funding from income groups and types of spending that normally is kind of affordable. In other words, people can pay for that. How do you think Schäuble's proposal went? How many of you think that it is building up momentum?
No.
Nope. How many of you think it is not building? It went down like a lead balloon. It went down like a lead balloon in Mr. Schäuble's own country. And just touch the driving habits of Germans and you see what you get. But nonetheless, we think that when we discussed it in the panel, we think that we have to prepare for, at least on a voluntary basis, those who are willing to do it, to encourage that kind of a solution. There is a precedent. Was it 9 countries, Daniel, that use the airline tickets? 9?
10.
Ten countries built a coalition. They decided to impose voluntarily on airline tickets a small tax. It is $1 for economy ticket, $40 for business, and I forgot how much for first class. When you buy a ticket in these countries, one of them is France, UK is not one of them, so you guys are safe. When you buy a ticket, $1 or 40 or a little bit more goes into a fund for immunization. It has collected $2.3 billion so far. And why immunization? Because when people are not immunized and they travel and they have transmittable disease, they can actually impact your health. So you're, in a sense, investing in a small insurance for yourself. That's the concept. We are thinking that a similar approach can be taken to fund humanitarian, especially health of refugees, for the same reason. When refugees do not have access to medical services, very bad things happen. Diseases that have been eradicated return. We have seen this with polio in Syria. And when they return, a multi-trillion dollar investment that we have made over decades gets eroded. So we are promoting this. I don't expect tomorrow to have acceptance, but I think that over time we may be able to create some support for a concept like this. Secondly, we believe that it is absolutely paramount wealthier countries that are currently not donors to step up to the plate. More wealth, more responsibility. Today we have very disproportionate burden, if I call it a burden or contribution. We have five most generous countries paying two-thirds of the humanitarian bill, two-thirds of this 25 billion. UK is one of them, by the way. It's United States, UK, European institutions, European Commission, not as a country, but as Europe as a whole. Sweden, Germany, did I get all five? These are and then if you take out the institutions, the Europeans as such, Japan would come as the next in line. I mean, obviously countries like China and Russia and Qatar and Saudi Arabia, they should do more. And we are thinking, rather than beating on them, to create a way to recognize when they do more, to have a recognition for it. The biggest surprise for us as a group when we started working on that was the complete and utter absence of the private sector from dealing with this problem. Amazing. Private sector contribution to humanitarian financing is only 5%. The private sector generates 3/4 of the 78 trillion GDP, but on this topic it's absent. And when you ask, why are they absent? Why? Huh? Because they are mostly approached for financial contributions as charitable giving, and not for what the private sector is best at, which is skills and capabilities to resolve problems and provide goods and services. So we have a lot in our work, and we already started some of the activities in that direction. To bring private sector, we have a very interesting engagement with especially the sort of new economy companies. One of them is IndigoGo. It's a company that is like a platform, connecting platform, to see whether they can connect goodwill people with UNICEF and other organizations to get more contributions. There is huge potential for the private sector. I'll give you only one example, digital identity. Today, when you are faced with a big problem, say you are in South Sudan, your village is destroyed, your family is on the run. You get to a camp, and in this camp, there would be UN, maybe Red Cross, maybe somebody else. They all provide different types of services, and they would register you for themselves for their accounting. So you queue on this line to get a tent, and then you queue on this line to get water and food, and you go then to another line for medical care. What we want to do is to get universally, what we are now doing actually somewhat in Lebanon and in Jordan, to get digital, to use new technology and be able to register everybody in one database, put it up there in the cloud. So if you are a refugee in Lebanon and, you know, you're registered, you have your finger print, if you come to Europe, we know who you are. If you go to Germany, we know who you are. If you're in Greece, we know who you are. If you are from Jordan going to Lebanon, we know who you are. And most importantly, all the assistance can be then channeled, loaded on this digital identity as digital cash and digital food and digital shelter and digital medical care. Of course, this cannot happen overnight, but it is possible to be done. And as I said, in Lebanon and Jordan, we do it. In Jordan, actually, the refugees are registered with their... is it iris on the eye?
Iris.
So you go to a cash machine. If you're a refugee in Jordan, you go to a cash machine, you stay in front of little, you know, scanner, you go blink, and you get cash. It's quite amazing. And of course, sometimes elderly people get kind of scared on that. But once you get accustomed to it, it is a very efficient system. We want to get the insurance companies brought into this. Risk financing is crucial. People have to be able to build more capacity to resist shocks, especially those caused by disasters. Very interesting Islamic social finance. Again, you look at this 15 billion gap. Zakat is mandatory voluntary giving. if you are a Muslim, you have to give. And you give between 250 and 560 billion dollars a year. This is the size of Zakat. If we can take 1% of Zakat to go into humanitarian finance, this closes between 2.5 to 5.5 billion of our gap. By the way, 90% of people affected by conflicts are Muslims. And yet the Muslim world is not yet quite chipping in to help these people. Last but not least, we want to get the media more engaged. We find it pretty devastating that the media kind of goes with the big stories. And so it's on the 6 o'clock news, and then the river of news moves on, but the people are still there, they're still suffering. How to get more consistent engagement so people, individuals, can be more engaged and giving more. One thing that is not on this list, but is maybe the most kind of jazzy thing we do, and Daniel here from my team who does it, we also want to create, we call it micro-levies, to get companies that have big span of transactions to adopt a pledge of 1 cent, 2 cents, 5 cents out of their transactions for humanitarian purposes. So his favorite
target
is, can anybody guess who he's targeting? Can you think of something that is very popular in Britain? It is a big transaction. Many, 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 many millions of tickets are being sold for it.
Football.
So he writes to FIFA, basically. We write to FIFA. He writes to people we sign with the Sultan. And our letter goes like this, in a very polite way. It basically says, you guys have a reputational problem. Do you want us to help you with it? And we'll see where this would take us. They have not said no. They haven't yet quite said yes, but we are trying to kind of allure him to come in. And the same applies to many other companies. I'm thinking of Uber or the Googles and the Facebooks of this planet, where the volume of transactions is such that a very, very small nano levy can generate hugely important impact, and again for our own security. The very last thing in what we do, it is actually the one that has grown really long legs. We call it grand bargain, and it is about efficiency of delivery of humanitarian aid. Those who work, if you were the humanitarian community, you immediately would get what I'm talking about. We have a system that was designed for a world that does not exist anymore. For the world of occasional short-term emergencies. A world that was 2 billion operation and it is now 25 and actually should be 40 billion. So the system is a little bit rusty and it needs a lot of improvement in terms of efficiency of how donors fund and how organizations function. And this is all about making these changes in the way this system operates. I will finish with this. We will have a big summit in May in Istanbul, World Humanitarian Summit. It's a chance for the world to actually look at itself in the mirror and recognize that what we see in the mirror is not very pretty. We have allowed the very, very basic notion of humanity to be eroded in our world. And that is so very obvious in the numbers of people who depend on us and don't get the help they need. But it is also a world where our own security, our own stability depends a lot on whether we can bring these flares of conflict and the impact they have on people down. And for us in Europe, absolutely paramount, because unless we get on top of this problem, the problem is going to get on top of us. So this is my story. It is a story about a country that should not exist. And I hope that you guys would walk out of here today thinking, well, maybe you can do something about it. At the minimum, maybe if we can get Uber and FIFA to do what they should do, use their services. Is Uber here in London?
Yeah.
Okay, so here we go. Know that a very small contribution from us, the remaining almost 6.8 billion people on the planet, would make a huge difference for those left furthest behind. So, thank you very much.
Inspiring talk, which I'm sure everybody in the audience welcomes. If you'll allow me, I'm going to ask one question before we go to the audience. Because what I want to try to do is to connect what you've just been talking about with your day job. The EU is due to have a budget review this year. The EU budget, if I remember roughly the figure in dollars, is 150 billion.
Euros.
No, in dollars.
Okay, you go ahead and I'll...
Roughly 150 billion. 10% of that would be your 15 billion.
Mm-hmm.
10% of the EU budget would be a third of the Common Agricultural Policy budget.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we just use this budget review to solve it?
This is where I can say I put our money where our mouth is. Since I became the person in charge of budget, we have very significantly increased funding for humanitarian emergencies. To be more precise, around 30% increase in this last year. And just to give you a sight of the humanitarian emergencies, we of course have the refugee crisis at home. In 2014, we started with 4.5 billion euros for last year and this year to deal with migration and with the impact of migration of crisis in the southern and eastern neighborhood. Now we are at 10.5 billion. So we have squeezed 6 billion euros in a budget where there isn't much space to squeeze. We have done something last week, which is absolutely critical. We have taken a decision to provide humanitarian aid inside Europe, something that we have not done before, by creating a new instrument for 700 million for now. It probably would grow 300 million for this year, keeping in mind primarily Greece, but not only, because the problem is now most acute in Greece. It may move to other places. This answer the part of your question. Within the flexibility of the budget, we have done the right thing, and we have contributed in this conference in London. We have been very forward leaning. It doesn't answer the second part of your question, which is, why don't you use the midterm review to significantly redistribute funding that is currently in agriculture cohesion, but not possible to go for this purpose. I don't know to what extent people know the EU budget. You guys know the EU budget? I feel blessed because anything I ask you know nothing about. So whatever I tell you is you. So great.
I know about the EU budget.
You know about the EU budget. Just a kind of a EU budget 101. The EU budget is planned and sealed for 7 years. Our funding horizon is 7 years. And every year we decide on the annual slice of this 7 years. The current funding period is from 2014 to 2020. And we have 960 billion euros in payments and about 1 trillion and 40 billion euros in commitments. Those of you who know budgets are probably scratching mentally your heads. How can we commit more than we can pay? Well, the logic is that you can never really use all the money you have. This logic is based on the past when the EU budget was always bigger than we can possibly spend. Believe it or not, year after year after year, until 2012, we would have leftovers of 500 million, 1 billion, 1.2 billion, 300 million that we cannot spend. Until 2010 working at the World Bank, and we had in 2009 a food crisis in the world. So what did we do? We called President Barroso in the European Commission and we said, Commission, can you please come up with $1 billion to deal with this problem? What did the Commission say? Sure! And wouldn't it be better if we come up with more? Because it was not a problem. These days, over. Over. Gone. They're gone for two reasons. One, because the needs in Europe since 2008 are continuously profound. And we see it. We are hit by crisis left, right, and center. Two, because thanks primarily to the UK, but also the Netherlands and some other net payers, our budget for the first time shrank. Talk about illogical budgetary process. Your needs are going up, but your budget is going down. Net result, last year we spent 99.9% of the budget. This year we are going to spend 99.95% probably of the budget. You know, and the 0.1 that we don't spend is because people submit wrong invoices and we can't pay on time. So what that means, to answer your question, is that when needs are going like this, people hold on their allocations, because another weird thing of the EU budget is that 80% of it is defined in shared management with member states in national envelopes, and it is untouchable. So, yes, we can look into ways to use better the money we have. This would mean take money from agriculture and use it also for the refugees. Simple example. Our farmers see milk prices collapsing. We give money to the World Food Program to buy milk from our farmers to lift up the prices. Huh? We achieved more things with the same euro. And of course, we would look into other ways to expand the flexibility of the budget. My simple message to you, if any of you wants to come and work for the European Commission, anybody interested? Huh? Okay, great. So we have somebody. And if you want to be part of the brave team that deals with budget, knock on my door. We are looking for brave people because the problems we have require ingenuity and bravery to be solved. Okay, so that's, and we can talk more about it.
Now let's go to yours. Yeah. What I want to do is take questions in groups of three. If people can say who they are, avoid making a speech, and be short and be very open to all of this. So, first Peter, and then going that way. And it's only men asking questions at the moment.
No, that's not
true. That's a change.
Yeah, I'm Haida Rida from Bain & Company. Thank you very much. Can you hear me? So I'm Haida Rida from Bain & Company. Thank you for your speech. My question was about ISIS. So ISIS is one of the key drivers of a humanitarian crisis in many countries. And what is worrying is that they have a really strong narrative that gets girls from Manchester to join them, people from Georgia, people from the US, people from Morocco, etc. And there seems to be a lack of an integrated and strategic counter-narrative. That counter-narrative could include political players like the EU, companies like Google, Twitter, academic institutions like LSE. What do you see as the role of these different players in building a narrative that makes these girls from Manchester understand that they're not joining a Robin Hood organization, but an organization that is killing, raping, at a scale that hasn't been seen in 1,000 years. Thank you.
Nasser Kalaoun, Commissioner, since you went to Lebanon, I'm sure you would have met our colleague Sigrid Kaag, who's UN Secretary General representative in Lebanon, who does field work visits there as well. But on personal experience, last year I went there and I got some feeling from people on the ground who help refugees. You know, when people knock the door of somebody who's a local headman to register them, I want to say national security headquarters, what I mean to say. Okay, what I mean to say that the system itself is bursten into under pressure. So even if there is money, how can you train the state bureaucracy, which is not trained, the national security, which registers refugees? I'm happy you said about the eye, iris and the eye. But the other possibilities, it will take a long time to train. Money is one thing, but I want to see from your opinion what other things can be done, since you now you lobbied for help on the ground. So in this case, how to squeeze it and make all these magical solutions on the ground there, not here. Thank you.
Okay, and the third question
is here. Hi, my name is Peter D'Souza. I'm a senior economist at DFIDS. So you made the very good point about there being a budget gap, and trends suggest that gap's going to rise. And then you spoke about ways to raise more funding towards meeting that gap. Guess another angle to look at it, in addition to that, is how to use existing funds better.
Yep.
I'm wondering if you can comment on that. You know, for example, why isn't the UN spending more on preparedness? Mm-hmm. Preparedness has much higher returns than kind of late response funding. You mentioned the idea about kind of EU using milk through the WFP. Another way, another alternative would be giving cash, which is good evidence to suggest cash is far more efficient than giving milk or grain to beneficiaries. And there's plenty of other kind of ways we can improve efficiency. So I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Okay. Well, that's three, so we'll
First on the question of ISIS. It is actually a bigger problem that we are undervaluing as such. And the problem is that we now have... I'm sorry, I'll get up so I can see people. We now have the very unfortunate development of rebel groups taking over territories without any interest whatsoever to become governments and to become internationally recognized. ICC is the most dramatic example, but if you look at Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, various clones of Al-Qaeda, this is spreading like cancer over big chunks of territory in Africa and the Middle East. Yemen is the latest to be seriously impacted also by that, but Libya, Syria, Iraq, you look at Central African Republic, South Sudan, Northern Nigeria, Mali, Somalia, and that is a huge failure of the international community to concentrate and work together to prevent that spread of cancer. In the past, people would want to beat the other guy and then take over, become prime ministers and presidents, and come here and shake hands with the queen. That is no more the case. And we have to think about this phenomenon and what do we do about it. And then, of course, you have the... And why is this connected to the 15-year-old girl in Manchester? Because when there is no ambition whatsoever to become a recognized government, of course, the attractiveness you put out is an alternative of governments, alternative of the world we live in. And that has its own weird charm. This rebellion attitude is something that, especially for young people, it's kind of attractive. Huh? That is a way of life that is outside of this structured, institutionally our way of life, the way that we have. It is, in that sense, a matter of not only Facebook and Google and all the platforms that these kids are using to recognize the danger and then what are the screens that can be put in place. It is not only about our media and the alternative model to be communicated. By the way, since the end of the first Cold War, what we are seeing is a dramatic decline in using communications to convey a way of life. When I was in Bulgaria, I was listening to BBC to learn what is happening on the other side of the Iron Curtain. Now, Russia Today is using the same approach to communicate. And where are we? I mean, we somehow lost the sense that you have to show in attractive way, in a targeted manner. You want to approach people. That is a bit of atrophy of our muscle. So I don't have an immediate solution. What I can say is that there are two aspects of the solution. One is for the international community to carefully assess this new phenomenon and what does it mean. If you ask me, what it means is that we have to get on the high road, forget about some of the divisive lines of those that are more or less in the same civilizational pattern and try to come up with a common platform. But this is excruciatingly difficult in a multipolar world that we live in, where the interests of some of the new powers are kind of short-sighted, and some of the old powers, to be very fair, short-sighted. No, I can't. In this case, I can't look at Daniel. Bulgaria has not been until before the 13th century a power of any kind. So I have to look at you.
I'm Scottish.
Oh, yeah. that changes it entirely. So that is one that hopefully there would be some awakening. We see some positive signs around the Syria conflict of different points of view trying to converge. Hopefully this would be happening. And then the second one is the whole field of communication. Who do we have to target? How to target them? And that is professional. I'm not a professional there, but professionals used to know how to do it. They should know how to do it today. On the UN system under pressure, and what can be done on the ground. I mean, in our report, we talk quite a lot about local capacity because first responders, because actually, who helps you when something bad happens to you first? Usually this is your neighbor, your family, and yet the humanitarian assistance today mostly goes to international organizations and through them, after many turns, may reach down to local organizations. We have to, and we do that for a reason, because of accountability, fiscal, you know, ability to demonstrate where the money goes. It is said, I wouldn't sign, but it is said that only 2% of international humanitarian aid gets into local organizations. How to correct that? Obviously, we have to all think how to build more bottom-up capacity and a faster move of resources to local organizations. Some of this is happening by local organizations creating consortia, building more capacity to present themselves. Some of it is happening with the traditional donors recognizing the need to support it, like in the European Commission we created the EU volunteers. It's a way to connect more to first responders. But simple fact is that it's not just a matter of money, it is also a matter of operational capacity to do that kind of work. Many of the organizations like ICRC, the Federation of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, they're getting much more engaged, not of delivering assistance, but helping bottom-up skills and capabilities to do it. On the how to use the funds better, actually the report, I was very economical on this because this is not the kind of professional development humanitarian audience, and I didn't want to kind of burden people with what we are proposing. But in this grand bargain, we have three elements. One, what donors and organizations ought to do together. And actually, use of cash is number one on the list. More use of cash, where cash is appropriate. But then we ask the implementing organizations to do joint assessments, not individual, to concentrate on harmonizing their cost structures, do performance reviews on a regular basis so they can constantly improve, and of course identify, eliminate overlaps. And we ask the donors to provide longer-term funding for longer-term crisis, predictable funding for predictable crisis, less earmarking, harmonize reporting requirements, reduce reporting requirements. On the point on milk that I made, yes, as a principle, the EU is very much oriented towards shift from in-kind to cash. But in this particular case, I pointed to, it was not that we had our natural surplus. It was a massive collapse of milk prices in Europe. And that led to very sizable 500 million euros packaged to help our farmers. And the question is, are we better off if we just push the cash their way, or we force them to do something more than just throw the milk when we have such a major increase of needs everywhere. I talked to the head of the World Food Program before we offered that. And she said, look, we are so desperate. You give me cash, I take cash and I prefer it. But you give me milk, I take milk. You give me peanut butter, I take peanut butter. Because and that's the reality, that the needs are astronomic vis-a-vis what they have as resource. And I'm saying this not to be taken that all of a sudden we changed our policy from cash to income. No. But when you are overwhelmed by crisis, you ought to do your best to address as much as possible competing needs.
I think that's what the game theory is called, win-win. Right, it's a woman's round now. Strictly speaking, I'm not allowed to identify a woman according to LSE rules. I can say the woman in red. Strictly, I'm not supposed to. So anyone who can identify themselves as a woman gets to ask a question.
Hi, I'm Arushi. I'm a strategy consultant with the Accenture. So the way I would see, it's about the money and it's about the money engaging the people. So the way I would break it up, and I'm sure you would have thought of this in several other ways of breaking it up, it's about the size of the pie, which is the budget we speak about. It's about the allocation and how it's allocated to the different parties and countries or organizations. And it's about efficiency, which was the point that was raised at the back. So your presentation was focused on the size of the pie, and the previous answer was focused on the efficiency of distribution. The part that I want to focus on is the middle part, which is how do we decide who gets what? And in terms of which countries are, country by country allocation, is it on the basis of the number of refugees or people impacted? And also which organizations, and do they pitch for it? What's the entire process like?
Any other woman versus to ask a question? And then over here.
Yes. Hello. Actually, I used to work with you in the UA Volunteers program. I was part of the pilot and then part of the DG Eco Policy team. And I was wondering one question that I had. I think all these are kind of a lot of the best practices that are already being discussed within the humanitarian community. And there is the World Humanitarian Summit coming up. And this is part, I guess, of the rollout plan that you're planning. But how are you planning more widely to roll out this out there from an advocacy perspective as well, and from... It's just that there are so many good suggestions, but you mentioned already a few of them that weren't very well received. Which are the ones that were well received already, and just a couple of the things that you see being successful when you speak with people about this?
Hi, I'm Sonia, I'm with the European Institute, LSE. Thank you for the talk, very inspiring. I was wondering, when you mentioned UK and other net payers into the EU budget, because with the talk of Brexit, there's a lot of mention of the UK paying into the EU budget, and that seems to be a frustration with sort of like pro-Brexit people. And I'm curious whether, apart from the fact that it's the EU solidarity and love of Europe, that should sort of be the argument for the UK to, because UK is a generous donor, even bilaterally, what they should be paying, whether there's some kind of a objective argument that why going through the EU would be sort of a better way to handle the crisis than through bilateral donorship. So, thanks.
Some challenging questions.
Well, the first on how we decide. The humanitarian aid is distributed on needs-based basis. So where there are needs, there is where help goes. There is no per country allocation as such. If in development cooperation there could be multi-year programs of per country allocation, in humanitarian aid it is on the basis of where are the people who need to be saved, whose lives are being affected. This being said, there are two factors that impact distribution of assistance. One is media. media plays a huge role because the cameras zero on the problem and then resources are more easy to generate. But what if you are not on the 6 o'clock news? 90% of the people in crisis are not. And so we have to be working very hard to bring objectivity. And the way we do it in the European Commission is we have in 40 or so hotspots of the planet our own offices, the eyes and ears of the European taxpayer, if you wish. But they're also the people who help us to make the decisions of allocation objectively based on needs. The second factor that is kind of moving a bit this is a protracted crisis. Some crises go on and on and on and on and on. And with time, we often see what is called donor fatigue. Even if the problem is there, the interest to come weakens. And this is why we think that humanitarian emergencies today, they need to be put in this context. We have to align humanitarian and development funding. One of the recommendations we make in the report is to concentrate development funds more on situations of fragility rather than everywhere, because fragility is becoming such a determining destabilizer globally. Secondly, how we decide who we give money to. It's the same thing, who has the skills and the capabilities. We obviously look at, is an organization that is locally placed? Do they have a track record on working on these types of issues, like dealing with refugees or with women or with children, if it is affecting children, or with health emergencies? We in the European Commission have 200 registered partners. These are organizations we have worked with, around 200. So we know each other, we meet every year, and we have that sense of community. The humanitarian community is quite a tight-knit community, and that is how you kind of try to be more effective by using the right partner. This being said, we do face competition among agencies that is unhealthy for this type of work. And in the report we talk about competitive inefficiency. Everybody fighting for the same resource in the same place, unhealthy. And what we want to see is more, we call it collaborative efficiency, and this is why we want, you know, common assessments. We want more collaboration, more collaborative spirit, and we believe that if the agencies do that, there will be more money, because the efficiency goes up and the trust in them goes up. That goes a little bit in your question. What we present as EU for each and every one of our member states, including the UK, is economy of scale. We are the only place where the locally positioned skills are in all, practically all, major emergencies areas. We put trained people, they serve everybody. And in the reviews that UK has done of different partners, ECHO, the humanitarian service of the Commission, ranks very well, very high. What we also provide to the UK is the capacity to bring resources in a critical mass. Yes, the UK is the biggest European donor, but within the EU, the totality of the EU, it becomes even bigger. I mean, we punch with a bigger force. I do believe that the UK is very important for the EU because of the tradition of development and humanitarian aid and the strong commitment. I mean, you went up to 0.7% of GNI, which we want others to do. But I also believe that being with the EU is very good for the UK because of this strength that we bring, plus the fact that within the EU, the slight irritant that comes from the UK being a former colonial power can be softened. Take me, I was humanitarian commissioner from a country that has never had any colonies. Much easier to be accepted. I have been very well received in many countries, and I carry that access and acceptability for all of us.
Okay, well, the last round of questions. Start here. Up to two more.
My name is Andrea. I'm an LSE alumnus. Thank you very much for your very important work and inspiring as well. My question is on the race for UN Secretary General. Because what got my attention was the commentary from the usual UK EU bashing crowd saying that you're using your position to campaign. And from my understanding, you're at the beginning, you're one of the main competitors, and I was hoping that you were going to campaign, but then your home country nominated someone else, and I was wondering if you wanted to use this opportunity to clarify.
Over here. Anybody else? If not, this will be the last question.
My name is Daniel. Thank you very much for your lecture this evening. I just want to ask how useful it's been having figures from the private sector on the panel, what they've been able to achieve, what you've been able to achieve with them. For example, has the gentleman at MasterCard been able to introduce a donation on every transaction that they have.
Okay, just last chance, just in time.
I'm Professor Badu, I have a question.
My name is Presaf. I do international relations at ALSE as an undergraduate. My question is, why do you think countries like Saudi Arabia have not got involved as much as they can, and what is the motivation behind that?
To the first question, many names have been mentioned and many more will be mentioned. And of course, I'm honored my name was also mentioned. I have been really blessed professionally because every job I do, it is for the job I have, not for some future job I may be getting. And in this sense, I am very, very, I wouldn't say honored, it's not an honor. I think I'm in the right place being in charge of the EU budget right now. Because of the work I did in the World Bank, I work with multi-billion budgets there. I think I'm serving European people well because we are getting bigger bang for our buck when we manage money well. And I took this humanitarian financing piece because my heart is in it. I have done all kinds of jobs. I was the World Bank representative in Russia, lived in Moscow in a very interesting period of time. It was in my office in the World Bank in 1999. I was then director for environment for the bank, where we invented carbon trade. And at that time, people would say, what? Trading with carbon? This is nonsense. But of all the jobs I have had, being humanitarian commissioner has been the job that made me a better person. And it left a sense of dedication to this, the people that have least access to the high corridors of power. And I would carry it with me for as long as I live. I always tell people this story because this is what put me on the journey that brings me this evening here. I mean, I could be at home in Brussels at dinner with friends. And it was, I was in my first year as humanitarian commissioner, and I had, at that time, my granddaughter was just a little baby. I was in Sofia playing with her, and she laughs and cries. And then the next day, I took a plane to Chad, and then I walked in a center for undernourished children, and straight in this room where there were about 40 children, and the room was dead quiet. not a laugh, but also not a cry. The children were so weak, they and this deafening silence I would remember forever. So then I walk out to the next room where the kids were recovering. They were in better shape, but they were crying. And I can tell you, I cried. I mean, I've never been so happy to hear children cry. And that sense that we somehow, in our busy lives, we accept that solvable problems are not solved. It's just kind of it shook me up, and this is I guess my hope is that in this evening and in all we do, somebody asked what we expect to happen with our panel report. We expect it that many of the ideas in the report would grow legs, walk out of the report, and they really happen. We certainly would get this grand bargain done, and there would be more efficiency in the system. My aim is to get at least $500 million to $1 billion squeezed out of efficiency, so kids that need our help can benefit from it. It's a long way to answer your question, but probably a good way to say we can be a little richer, maybe we can have bigger houses, maybe we can have bigger cars to drive. Is that what makes us human? And what happens with what how is it that in the world we are losing sight of the fact that some of us live fantastic lives and others are destined to be in this country? You asked me on the private sector. You know, the MasterCard guy got to be invited to be on our panel because MasterCard partners with the World Food Program to get digital food and now also to get digital shelter. They do it at no profit, only at cost. So they are not donating. They actually did a little bit of pro bono work for the World Food Program. They do pro bono work to promote this idea of using new technologies to cut the cost of delivery of humanitarian assistance. The other member of the panel is private sector member is from the Middle East, from the United Arab Emirates, and he has taken on an initiative to build SMEs' contribution to humanitarian aid, and of course his company is also making now more of a contribution in terms of their own financial inputs. But the more important thing is that the two of them are taking a very important step with the Global Compact. The Global Compact is this agreement of the private sector to be more responsible in global development, to create a humanitarian chapter of the Global Compact. So companies can say, logistics company can commit to provide logistics in delivery after a natural disaster, or pharmaceutical company can deliver at cost or even better as contribution medicines in disaster. So they're going to try to build this new humanitarian avenue. Saudi Arabia actually, it's an interesting place. They do provide quite a lot direct bilateral humanitarian assistance. They occasionally provide funding to the United Nations, sometimes very generous. Boom, $300 million. Problem is that they are not predictable. They give $300 million check today and nothing next year. And the second problem is that very often in their bilateral assistance, they are not neutral to who they provide assistance to. The very basic principle in humanitarian aid is to be blind for the color of the skin, the religion. They are not there yet. And so the question is how, what we do. And when I was humanitarian commissioner, my answer to this question was engage relentlessly. We have to talk to each other, even if we disagree. How on earth are we going to ever agree if we don't talk to each other? And this is what we are trying to build, the big tent, everybody work together. Thank you all very, very much.
You've already shown your appreciation. I think we can all accept that not only is Kristalina a better person for doing humanitarian work, but there's even a chance that some of you will become better people as a result of what she's telling us tonight.